Welcome to Sanity, a podcast by the New York Sun. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and along with my co-host, Rebecca Sugar, we'll try to help you make sense of the nonsense and impart a little bit of sanity to your week.
We like to start every show with a quote about sanity, and this one comes from entrepreneur and investor Naval Ravikant, who said, "A rational person can find peace by cultivating indifference to things that are out of their control," which, given the markets the last 24 hours, is exactly what we need to hear.
Very zen. Maybe I'll try looking at that when I open up my savings account, Rebecca.
Maybe you should just not look for a few days.
Better not to look. Well, it's kind of a wacky week this week. We have a lot to talk with you about.
Every week is a wacky week.
Every week is a wacky week.
Trump world.
But I hope your Liberation Day hangover is going okay. We're going to start with our top story, and that's the beautiful tariffs that now govern America's trade relations with the rest of the world. Well, in our Make It Make Sense section, we're going to go across the pond, actually, and talk about Marine Le Pen and some of the drama coming out of Paris this week. And our tipping point, we'll be coming back to D.C. and talking about one of our favorite friends, Elon Musk, and his role in the administration, which could be on the verge of changing, maybe even by the time you listen to this episode. And then we'll round it out with our sunburns, as always. So, Becca, let's start. We're the day after Liberation Day. We had that big sort of lists of tariffs printed out and shown to the world. Neither one of us are economists. Stunning admission, I know. But what are your initial thoughts? Yeah. How did you react to it?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I feel liberated yet, but I'm waiting.
Liberation is a process.
Sometimes it's a delayed response. Look, I think in the world of Democratic resistance to absolutely everything that this administration has done, this struck me as maybe the first time where I feel like it's useful and helpful to have this debate over the policy that's been launched. It's not just resistance for resistance sake. There's actually meat on the bone here. There's real arguments on both sides. And so that's new and sort of interesting when we're, you know, what, 75 or 80 days into the Trump administration. I think initially I was so on, you know, the Bacha Unger Sargon train of like, you know, power to the people and all of these, you know, auto workers and steel workers who are going to get their plants back and get their jobs back, and the Rust Belt was going to come alive again. And I really think that narrative is very powerful. And I think it's real and true. Then, of course, I saw an interview with the great Thomas Sowell, an actual economist, maybe the most preeminent one in the world today that I know of. And he is cautious, you know, slightly negative about the potential trade war that has just been unleashed, and sort of suggests that it might be a useful tool if there is a short-term vision and plan. But absent that, and we haven't heard anything that would suggest otherwise, absent that, we're looking at something that could be quite terrifying across the globe. So I'm going to always side with Thomas Sowell over Bacha Unger Sargon, but I'm going to say that I don't want to, and I think it's important not to minimize the narrative piece here and the voice that President Trump is giving to a population, that's his part of his base now, which is sort of shocking if you understood that 30 years ago, they were Democrats, these people. But besides that, these are working people who have not been represented, and they are getting a voice by Donald Trump. And in that sense, the Sargon version of this makes sense to me, too.
With all due respect to Batya, who is my editor at The Forward, it's very difficult for me to get on board, Rebecca, with these tariffs. I think you're absolutely right that this is a substantive issue. It's more than an economics issue for Trump. It's how he sees the world. It's of course a negotiating tactic, as everything is. And I think you're right that it is part of his kind of primal connection with his voters. Mm-hmm. There's no coincidence that at the announcement yesterday there were hard hats in the audience. I just think that the how matters. The invocation of a kind of restoration of a golden age of manufacturing obviously is going to be compelling. Is this the way to get there? And I I'm just sort of doubtful that forget about, you know, a hammer versus a scalpel. This is a bazooka in terms of policy. I also, you know, and maybe I'm a little bit old fashioned this way, I'm sort of, you know, more a free trader than not. I think that it's good that for products and ideas to sort of move around the world. Now, of course, you need some rules of the road. There's no question about that. But these, I think, even for veteran trade economists and sort of economy watchers, are sort of really pretty extraordinary. I mean, the numbers that are being bandied about and now implemented are really unprecedented and take us back to, I don't know, the 19th century, some time before.
Listen,
that.
Listen, first of all, I have to say you're too young to be old-fashioned. But more importantly, I think that what you say is true, which also from a political lens, you look at President Trump and think, what a gamble, what a bet he's making, right, on this policy and on himself and on the idea that this is a negotiation and that, you know, everyone's hair is on fire, but that in a week or two, he's maybe expecting to get a phone call from China or somebody else to renegotiate this. It's quite a political gamble, even for somebody who's not going to run again.
Mm-hmm. I think because, you know, I think the mantra of this second Trump term is all cards in the middle, all chips in the middle of the table.
Yeah. This is quite a stunning risk to take that he didn't have to take.
My question is, you know, what if this just makes everything more expensive, the economy worse, and America poorer?
Right.
I mean, that's the danger here, is that.
Absolutely.
And what if it doesn't really help people?
Right. Donald Trump is saying, and what if it makes everything better and restores America to its manufacturing glory? And that's the risk he's taking. And to be fair, this is not a surprise. I think people thought that the actual baseline tariffs of 10% were going to be double, 20%. He campaigned on this. So it may feel shocking in the moment. It shouldn't be entirely shocking that he went here unless people just didn't believe he was going to really do it.
But I think to some extent, I mean, you know, Trump ran on, and his pitch for a long time has been, I'd say, one, immigration, and two, the economy. And so it's a gamble on an area that, you know, he beat President Biden on.
Yes.
And that was high prices. People felt the economy was sluggish, even though the market was good. It didn't feel good. And what if this drives up inflation, drives down people's, you know, savings? It makes everything more expensive. I'm kind of baffled by it that way. And also, you know, one of the things the president's job is to be a steward of the economy. I mean, you know, if this were your, you know, someone managing, you know, your retirement account, this would be crazy behavior.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's not just a thought experiment. It's the American economy that is being subject to a really wild gamble.
Yeah. I suppose I can't disagree with the words coming out of your mouth. And yet I sort of look at the system we've been operating under, and one could have, but largely didn't, say the same thing about the waste, the fraud, the abuse, the way our government spent our money and wasted our money and put us in debt was an equal threat to people's retirement accounts and to their livelihoods and to their lives. And yet it's this trade war has set off rightly, but also maybe hypocritically, this concern about how our money is being handled and managed.
Yeah.
And I want to say this at the risk of sounding naive and silly and like I'm wearing a MAGA hat, which I'm not, that maybe President Donald Trump, Howard Lutnick, others in his cabinet, Scott Bessent, maybe they really believe in the long-term future remedy here and are willing to pay the short-term price and make Americans pay it along with them. They've said as much. And
I mean, to be fair, Trump has said, I don't care if the costs go up. I don't deal with it. You know, and I just, that's a very sort of dangerous tack to take. I mean, if the economy slides into a recession, all of a sudden, you know, we've been tracking on this program, the Democrats being lost in the wilderness. All of a sudden, there's a path right out of the wilderness.
I hear it's risky, but I have to say, maybe the path out of the wilderness that he's most concerned with is that Social Security was going broke and that, you know, workers were, their jobs were being sent offshore and nobody cared and nobody was remedying that. So I'm not defending it economically because I can't. Mm-hmm. I'm only saying that I'm not sure that we were in a stable position and he took us into an unstable one. Mm-hmm. My sense is we were in a pretty unstable situation mm-hmm. to begin with, and maybe he's just changed the goalposts around the instability.
Yeah, and listen, to be fair, and you would ask, you know, kind of the gold star economists and the Nobel Prize winning economists, and major mistakes were made in the international trade system. I mean, the era of nobody on the right or the left is wants to go back really to the days of NAFTA and the days of sort of really easy free trade and total cheap. So the consensus has shifted, and fair play. I think the recognition that you know adjustments were needed. Trump is taking a position, a minority position. That's really an outlier position, I guess, is what I want to say. It's not, this isn't right versus left. This is Trump versus everyone.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
And I just worry that, you know, where do we go from kind of politics to policy and how is it overlapping? I mean, tariff has become, you know, Trump's key to all mythology. It's his answer to everything. And I just, you know, I don't know about that.
Well, I guess we're going to find out, and I hope not the hard way. But if we have a soft landing, to borrow a phrase here from this, maybe you'll take everything you just said back.
Maybe. I'll just say, you know, it feels a little bit like, okay, you have two people who are painters, and one of them is Michelangelo, and the other is someone who throws paint on the wall. I mean, you know.
Jackson Pollock made a lot of money.
Jackson Pollock is an amazing artist. I'll die on that hill. But maybe we're watching a Pollock in process. Maybe if I lose all my money, maybe I'll be a street Jackson Pollock impersonator.
Okay. This show is not called Insanity, so let's not go there. All right, let's move on before we actually lose it to make it make sense. So let's try to make some sense of something that maybe we can make sense of. I kind of called this A to France, U to France. What just happened with Marine Le Pen and in France as echoes of what's been happening across a lot of other European countries. And what do you think? Do you want to lay out what just happened and your reactions to it?
Sure, absolutely. The place to start here is last year, where President Macron, a centrist, called a snap election after some negative polling and voting results in the European Parliament. And the first round, France has a very complicated, as you'd imagine, complicated election system. And the first round showed Marine Le Pen's right-wing party National Rally get the most votes. Second round saw
not enough to
make her president.
Yes.
And then the second round was kind of like a boxing match. The left wing got sort of polled well. They kind of tied to lots of parties together, and so France is basically a hung country right now. Macron is still the president, but it's deadlocked. Early polls showed Marine Le Pen as a front runner in 2027. Mm-hmm. Macron is term limited, so he's a lame dunk. Yeah. He'll be out. And then this bombshell ruling came down, finding her guilty of embezzling funds that were intended for use in the European Parliament, paying her own staff, and the penalty was severe. It was not only kind of monetary, but also barring her from running for president. So she's appealing, but
a prison sentence. 2 years in house arrest.
So as of now, she's not able to run. Of course, we went through this whole process where we had a major front runner for president, eventual winner, tried multiple times. Le Pen has used the word lawfare, as has Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel, to describe this phenomenon. Just to give a little bit of background, and, Le Pen is the daughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen, who was pretty notorious, who just died recently at almost 100, anti-Semite, and he sort of the party is descended from sort of the Vichy kind of anti-Semitic far-right French strain, which is a strain in their sort of political system. Le Pen, though, has made efforts to distance herself, has renamed the party, shown support for Israel and for against anti-Semitism to such an extent that some French Jews, and I've written multiple stories on this, have actually said, you know, hold my nose and vote for Le Pen, which would have been astonishing for someone to say 20, 30 years ago.
Absolutely, yeah. So what do you make of the decision to, A, you know, sentence her and go after her for this crime? And then I think, B, and it's a slightly separate but related issue, is to ban her from running. The two don't necessarily have to go together, but in this case they did.
I think I would say, you know, as much as possible, it's important to separate those two things. You know, with the recognition every legal system is different. And I, you know, I said this on with the effort to disqualify President Trump from the ballot as an insurrectionist, which was rejected by the Supreme Court. And I think it's fair to say we want to hold politicians accountable for corruption. But the ban, you know, risks one risks a backlash. I mean, and risks being anti-democratic, just to be kind of blunt about it, right?
I don't even know it's a risk. I think it is.
It is. It is. Yeah. And removes from the ballot someone who has significant support in the French political system. We can look at this in terms of a sort of abstract way. Is this how we would design it? The other way to look at this is, you know, is the far left now going to be empowered? And in people don't know, the far left in France is really anti-Semitic. Yeah. I mean, it's Mélenchon and has assembled a group that is pro-Hamas, right? And so what happens when you take out one piece of this jigsaw puzzle?
Yeah. And look, I think it's worth reminding everyone also that Macron was accused just a few short years ago of taking EU funds and spending it through McKinsey. If you remember, that whole scandal came out, and spending huge, I think it was €1 billion on consultancy fees. And so misappropriating funds as well. And guess what? He was not charged and he was not convicted. And so the political, you know, reasoning for going after Le Pen seems obvious and clear, and it seems a pattern across Europe. We've talked about Romania,
selective prosecution,
Germany, and you know, using the judicial system to prevent your political opponents from defeating you has become a theme in the Western world, and it's literally the place where those ideas were supposed to have been, you know, eradicated. I mean, this was democracy, and so nothing sadder than to see France in particular fall victim to this, but not entirely shocking either, given the trajectory of Western Europe that we've talked about a lot. And I think that it's also no, you know, coincidence that all of the countries where this has happened, it's the target has always been a populist who's the opposition. So there's also this, you know, elite versus the people narrative, which is exactly mirroring what we're experiencing here. And so, you know, again, like maybe back to the Naval Ravikant quote, it's, you know, we're not French citizens and we can't really do much about it over there except amplify the story. But I think the goal is always to learn from these stories and to remind ourselves where we were in this country just, what, less than a year ago, where to some degree that many in the Trump administration would say we still are now, where the use of our judicial system, it's sort of a it's being used by political opponents to suppress the will of the people via their elected officials.
I mean, we did an interview this week with a young French politician here in the office, Shannon Saban, and she's in Macron's party and is adamantly opposed to both Le Pen and Mélenchon. But I think if you are, you want to beat them at the ballot box. You want to beat them in the realm of ideas, right? And the danger, and one of the lessons of European history, and of course history can always be twisted to contemporary ends, is that by boxing someone out, by excluding them, you can amplify them.
Donald Trump. Can we just say Donald Trump?
Yeah, Donald Trump. I mean, you know, I went back and looked at, if you chart the criminal case and the bringing of charges, the convictions, they, you know, Yes. They mark spikes in his support. Yes. And
Letitia James and Alvin Bragg should get like a commission.
Yeah, maybe place in the cabinet. And, and they might have cost Ron DeSantis the presidency, honestly.
Yeah.
The broader question of Europe, which we've discussed, is fascinating right now. I think the rise of populism, as generally these populist parties are more pro-Russia, how that plays out, as America shifts, America tariffs, how does Europe respond? Yeah. So Europe's a really, the old world is a hot story right now.
Yeah, sad one for those of us who remember it decades ago as a very, very different place.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So onward to the turning point. Mm-hmm. You called Elon Musk your friend. So you go first. Talk about your friend.
Hardly. Well, it seems that things are building with Elon Musk this week. We had the special election in Wisconsin where his preferred candidate for Supreme Court justice lost despite $25 million. And then a report in Politico yesterday that Trump is looking about on ways to ease Elon out. I think Elon is sort of a double-edged sword for Trump. On the one hand, he blocks some of the heat. You know, if anyone kind of gets more press than Trump, it's Elon or close to as much. On the other hand, you know, he's not very popular politically. He's not popular, obviously, on the left, but even increasingly on the kind of pro-tariff populist right, he's seen as kind of an oligarch. And so I wonder if we're kind of ending the life sell-by date on the Elon role in government and starting to think about what his legacy will be. And I think it's a mixed one. I think, you know, spotlighting obviously wasteful spending and cutting it is something that had been talked about but never done. On the other hand, you know, how it was done and, you know, sort of putting the pieces back together will be a big job, I think.
Yeah.
So we're not saying, a farewell yet to Elon, but I think maybe the winds are shifting.
Yeah. I don't think he's going to be your friend after he hears you
that.
I am going to be his friend because I am nothing but grateful to him for what he's done. I actually think he hasn't gone far enough. I wish he had done even more. I'm not convinced, Caroline Leavitt came out after that Politico report and said, it's not a true story. Mm-hmm. He said himself, Elon Musk, if you saw, I don't think you saw the Brett Baer Doge interview with Elon, but he very clearly said that he had committed to 130 days and we're
He's around 70 now.
Yeah. So, you know, yeah. I don't know that he's leaving tomorrow and I'm not sure what will happen on his 130-day deadline. But he also was very confident in that interview that he could achieve the goals he had set out for himself and for Doge within that 130 days, which is an astonishing idea that he could do all that he's done.
I don't think he can. The goal is $1 trillion. He's not going to cut $1 trillion.
All right. But I mean, we'll cut him some slack if he comes in at 900 billion. But whatever the number is, my instinct is to just say thank you, not just for the actual cuts themselves, but for highlighting to the American people, which he's done really, I think, masterfully along with his team. And you have to watch that interview because it was a turning point to our point here. It was a moment when people, if they were willing to watch and they're not busy out keying his cars, that they were willing, if they were willing to watch, they were able to see the authentic interest by these people. A businessman from Houston was on that panel talking about the five businesses he left behind and the family he left behind, because he just really believes that he has a role to play in saving the country from bankruptcy, right? The CEO of Airbnb and just, engineers and guys who felt they had something to offer. He's coalesced around him a team of people who seem to me really care about the future of this country and were willing to do something that, as you said, no one else is willing to do, right or left, Republican or Democrat. Everyone, Cory Booker can spend another 25 hours on the floor of Congress.
Please don't.
Screaming about this and making a fool of himself. But he has been in the Senate for some time and in Congress, and he has done nothing to have oversight. Who knows which hand he might have in what cookie jar, as do the rest of them.
I agree with you, Becca. I just think
Elon Musk, is what we should be saying.
Maybe. But for example, two stories this week of things that were cut just drove me crazy. I mean, cutting, contraceptive to poor people in Africa. Well, how does that make us better? How does that make us stronger? And, and cutting, medicine and vaccine. I just, you know, it's the chainsaw. I just...
Yeah, I don't know about each specific case. I mean, there were cases of things that were cut that were reinstituted.
Yeah.
And as he said, you know, listen, you're doing a job of this size. If you expect him to be like... the, you know, if bat 1,000, as he said in this interview, it's an unfair expectation. If things get caught up in the bucket.
But these are life or death issues for people.
Yeah, I mean, they are.
You have to kind of bat 1,000.
So is our country going bankrupt, life and death for a lot of people. And so.
But this isn't going to save our country from going bankrupt.
It's a good start. I like it. And I think this issue of the sledgehammer and the scalpel and whatever, you know, permutation of that people use is used as a way to not address that sometimes things have to be smashed and then put back together rather than delicately taken apart. Nobody was even willing to delicately take it apart, I should point out. But if he's not doing it the way we liked, I mean, the how does matter, but sometimes somebody has to just go in and do something. And I'm going to defend him and fight you on this because I really think that he did something of great import for this country that will have ripple effects for generations. And aside from that, I just want to say that, you know, the response, the keying of Teslas, the blowing up of Tesla factories is suggestive of something deeper than just, I don't like the way he's doing it, right? There's deep fear around the exposure of some of these programs and some of the waste and the fraud and the abuse. And you know, people are coming out of the woodwork to try and stop it for a reason, not because they're concerned that he's not using a scalpel.
Yeah. No, I there's no question that a lot of the opposition to him is sort of crazy. I mean, he's very much in the public eye. He's very much a public figure. I mean, his persona is combative. So, you know, no defending all that crime. I guess I just worry at a higher level, like an America that has these kind of impossibly high tariffs, that's cutting back on sort of life-saving medication abroad, just seems to me a more miserly America, like a more kind of insular and you know, and like you said, there was a lot of waste. There was a lot of fraud and cut that all. You know, I don't know what, you know, slashing the NIH, slashing research, slashing, I mean,
it doesn't bother me as much as it bothers you.
Yeah, I guess,
listen, I think, you know.
Like the Musk-Trump vision of America in the world is really meager to me.
Yeah.
It's a really impoverished.
It's funny. I see it differently. I see it as the opposite. Actually, I think their vision is of, you know, in Donald Trump's parlance, like, we're going to be the richest country in the world. I think they see so much abundance and so much wealth accruing to Americans that the spillover will be to everyone's
benefit. I worry that tariffs are going to make us poorer.
Yeah,
that's the thing,
maybe
right?
Maybe in the short term, but I think
in the long run, we're all dead.
All right, if we all die before it happens, I'll apologize.
Yeah, I hope we don't.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Sunburn time. That felt like sunburn.
It was good. It was good. I loved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are
Go
you
ahead.
Okay? I'm going to start. No surprise. I'm riffing on Europe again. I tried to sort of pick something else, but I can't.
Yeah.
Sort of tolerate what's happening in Europe. And this is just one particular case that I wanted to draw everyone's attention to. It's an Irish teacher named Enoch Burke, who back in 2022 had a male student who said that he identified as a they and wanted his teacher, Enoch Burke, to call him they. And Mr. Burke refused. He's a religious man. He just believes that the truth is, and it is, that there are only men and women and that, you know, pronouns and language matters, and he refused to call them they. He was summarily fired by the school, and then he's been in sort of court and legal tussles with the school ever since. He actually was imprisoned a few times for going back to the school when he was told not to. But recently, this past week, he appeared in a video on X showing his phone and his bank account, which read €0. Hmm. The courts in Ireland ruled that all of his assets could be seized and gave the Attorney General permission to go and pursue his other assets as well, potentially his home and car and all those things. So for the great speech crime of, you know, being a teacher and using proper grammar and being a human being and understanding that there are two sexes, this man's entire life savings was wiped away by a government that just decided that they can control people's speech. And I just go back to last week's Sunburn, where I talked about CBDCs and central bank digital currencies. And again, the point of these stories is not just to rant about them, but to amplify the lessons that we should be learning. And here in America, we should be very careful about letting people, governments, control our finances, because at the touch of a button, they can make them disappear.
Mm-hmm. Great. I feel like this is almost becoming a pattern, but I want to highlight something I thought was good.
I thought you were going to say Columbia University.
No. I don't even know what that is. This is a speech given by Simon Sharma. Simon Sharma is a historian at Columbia, actually, an art historian and just a general historian. And we'll kind of find a way to get all you guys the link to the speech. But just a rousing defense of Zionism against a sort of recent push in the world of the arts and intellectuals to not only criticize it, but delegitimize it.
Is it a speech, sorry, you gave, or a class?
A speech. And takes on, you know, Pankaj Mishra and Peter Beinart and all of this thing. It's an advance of a documentary on the 80th anniversary of the Holocaust that coming out soon. And I just think this is a really important fight. It's a fight I'm dedicated to as someone who thinks of themselves as, you know, in the world not only of news, but also in the world of arts and culture. And the situation has become absolutely intolerable. I think this is an important fight and a fight worth having. We talked to on our interview, which you'll get on Sunday, to the president of University of Austin. But so this question of, you know, do we kind of create our own, you know, intellectual and cultural worlds, or do we fight for one that's rapidly, you know, going down the drain? I think is a real question I'm thinking about these days.
Did Professor Sharma come down on either side of that debate?
Well, he's engaging. I mean, I picked up the New York Review of Books this week, and there was an article on the Holocaust and Israel that was just utterly appalling. Mm. That's kind of nice. Utterly appalling. And the fact that this can be published in, you know, the kind of foremost journal of ideas is just right. Like talk about a four alarm fire, wow. You know. I'm thankful for Professor Sharma, and also, you know, just a word that to say that speaking up matters, you don't have to go along with the herd.
Yeah. All right.
Great. Thanks.
Good to see you.
Yeah.